Come on, people. It's time to live it up.
Hello.
This is Rosemary Rodriguez, your host of the Director's Chair on WePlayRadio.com. Our guest tonight is Janine Sherman Barwa, writer extraordinaire.
Woohoo!
I'm really happy you're here. So, Janine, just to tell you a little bit, Janine and I met on Third Watch, where she was a writer, and she went on to do ER, where she was executive producer, and then Criminal Minds. All big network, very popular, a lot of fans of the show.
Right.
Big stuff that you did for the last few years. And so now you're developing.
I have an overall deal at Warner Brothers.
Totally kick ass.
Yeah.
So we met when I did my second episode of TV. It was a little bumpy.
We hated each other initially.
No, not at all. No, but you were cool. The whole point of this podcast is to talk about collaboration.
Right.
And I was very excited that you were coming here tonight because I feel like you're just somebody, I got to collaborate with you so many years ago and then you became like such a good friend. Like you are like my heart. Okay, when are we going to do that again? So who knows? But there's been many collaborations with a lot of different people along the way.
Right.
So the whole point of this for me was, to be able to have discussions with people that are in the trenches every day and to find out what works, what doesn't work, you know, and just different experiences that you had without naming names because we all got to play politics.
No, let's name names.
Oh, can we? Oh, shit, for real? I would love to. I'm just waiting for somebody to get there. All right, why not?
Who's listening?
Who knows?
Exactly.
But anyway, so the first, you know, one of the first things I wanted to ask you about was something that I think is a myth,
right?
Is the expression that TV is a writer's medium. Just to start out controversial now.
Oh, wow.
So how do you feel about that?
I feel it's writer's medium. I mean, I'm absolutely against.
All right, we're going to start big. Right,
exactly. I mean, you got the DJ over here. You got the Writers Guild over here.
Fuck yeah.
And I think, you know, the history of film was that film was a director's medium. And the DGA sort of controlled the film sets and made sure that the director was in charge. And in television, it became a writer's medium where the creator or the voices, the people who wrote the show, that brought the show to life, were the people in charge. And because the writers are there for every single episode, and because the writers are there from a lot of them from the birth to the end of the show, or the birth to like the first 4 years or the first 3 years, and then they move on, I feel like I'm a stickler on it's a writer's medium. Can it be a combo platter? Sure. But I'm not ready to say it's a director's medium. I just can't.
I don't think it is a director's medium. I think everything that we do is collaborative. That's my opinion.
It is collaborative. However, if you were doing a big studio movie, you know, like...
That's a huge collaboration.
It is a big collaboration, but it is definitely a director's film. And the director is not... The director might invite the writer to set, but it's not necessarily that they're welcome to set.
And that's sort of... That's almost like a precedent set.
Yeah.
That's like the previous generation. That is old news. And it needs to change. That's my opinion.
I agree with you.
Because why should anyone be treated like crap, really, or pushed aside when they wrote a script and their movie is based on their script?
Right.
So that doesn't make sense that they would be pushed aside.
Right.
And it doesn't make sense that a piece of paper with ink on it is a fully realized. Like no one's running all of that unless you actually.
Are producing it.
Production.
And you're a writer producer.
Correct.
Right.
But all the I would say 85 to 90% of the writers that I know are not actually producers. They're writers, but they have that credit. Like, I feel like the DGA kind of like sort of went that way.
Wow.
No, it's nothing wrong with that.
I don't think everyone has to know production.
I think people know are great writers. I'm not putting, that's not meant as a dig, by the way.
No, I don't even mean it as a dig. I don't know how many writers you know, but I know a lot of writer producers who produce. Like, I work on shows that people produce. And so
everyone that's in the writer's room that has a producer credit, are they really producers?
Yeah, they have the ability to produce, and they're producing.
So maybe the definition of a producer also needs to be clarified.
Well, and maybe you could have worked on shows where there is a person at the top that's mm-hmm. doing it all, mm-hmm. but that is not what our guild wants or desires.
That's interesting.
So where we met on a John Wells show,
right?
Where writer producers actually produce. Where you cast the show, where you help find locations, where you edit the show.
Right.
Like when you guys stayed in New York and you were done shooting and you would do your cut, like we did a cut of the show.
Right.
We did post-production on the show. We sweetened the show. You know what I mean? And so it's a bigger issue. We're in charge of making sure episode 4, 5, 6, and 7 all connect. Are they crescendoing to the end?
Right.
Whereas the director might be off on to Game of Thrones, or they're on to, like, right. you know, whatever. TV show next.
Right, right.
But you're there with it.
Well, I think that's part of the problem that I have in general, being a guest director, is that there isn't a template for how a television show is produced. And I think there needs to be more of a template so people understand and can be educated as to right. their roles. And a lot of times I feel like there's people thrown into jobs they don't really fully understand, because there's so many shows now.
Well, I think a lot of times what happens is you get a director, they are immediately linked up with the line producer, the UPM. They're right. linked up with physical production.
Right.
And there's a belief in physical production, those producers, that they're producing the show,
mm-hmm.
that they're getting the grips, they're doing this, they're getting the lights, they're getting, you know, mm-hmm. they're doing all of this thing, and they believe they're producing the show. But in a television format, that's part of producing. That is the line producing of the show. But there's a
bigger element. I would have to disagree because right. there are those people.
Well, there are some people like, but I'm talking some people about, like that then throw the writer producer under the bus. That they, you know what I mean? They believe that they are actually the ones doing the job, and they throw the writer producer under the bus. Whereas the writer producer,
I don't think I've experienced that.
Okay.
Those politics mm-hmm. so much,
mm-hmm.
to be honest with you.
Okay, good.
Because I feel like people sort of own their part, and when they're the line producers, they're kind of down in the trenches, yes.
Right, they're serving the script.
Yes.
But the script and the vision continuously changes based upon the writer.
Right, and that's where the problem comes. Because when people don't necessarily right. understand, there's just this animosity, and I just want, you know, I feel that as a member of the Directors Guild,
right.
as a person who works with other people all the time, trying to do this podcast, like,
right.
I just feel like there's animosity with people because they don't necessarily understand jobs, or something's going on where instead of it's a whole collaborative spirit,
right.
it's like, okay, I have this script and it's like 10 pages too long, and hey, this location may not. Sometimes that conversation is impossible to have.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes there's just some backstory to the whole thing where it's like, wait, I actually give a major shit about
right,
this like
right.
show, and about taking your script and making it great. Like, I, this
right.
is not to try to take away from you at
right,
all.
Right.
Not you, but you know what I mean? And sometimes I feel like there's a history or tradition that comes in the way as like a roadblock, and people get scared, and it's like, and I don't even mean with me, I mean with
the politics of
making a TV show. And I would like to be able to chip those walls down and sort of
right.
educate people, so we're all educated on, like, what is it like when you write a script and then it's released to, you know, production, and then what happens, and
right.
are you included enough? Or should you be flying to LA? Should you be flying to Atlanta? Should
right.
you be should on
you be
set?
In set? Yeah.
Should you, you know, should editors go out there and actually, you know, there are right. editors on years of a series that never actually go to set. They've never met the actors.
Which doesn't make any sense.
But this is what happens.
But this is real, yeah. I think a lot of people are territorial about their jobs. Mm-hmm. And I do think, I mean, like we met on a John Wells production mm-hmm. where it's very, great. Very well organized. It's a well organized ship, extremely well produced.
Yes.
And then I went on to ER and then even onto Criminal Minds, which was managed originally by Ed Bonera, who came from the John Wells camp. Mm-hmm. So there was a very tight way of doing those shows.
Which also, I mean, that's my first jobs, but I felt like the director was very respected.
The director was very, very, very respected. But
I remember we watched, like, when I turned in my director's cut, all the writers got together, and we all watched it together.
Right.
Like, we actually sat and watched. Right. I've never done that since.
So that's what happens on Criminal Minds, too. Like, we would watch it together, and we'd all give notes. I think what happened...
With the director?
The director would turn in their cuts.
Right. I'm talking
you'd
about
watch
with
it alone.
The director.
Because, well, what would happen, because I think that changed, but what happened is a lot of times you're not being forthcoming when the director's in the room. Mm-hmm. You are forced into a position to be nice, and you don't really have time to be nice. If you're doing 22 episodes or you're doing 24 episodes, and you actually have to give notes, and there's actually problems with the cut. Because mm-hmm. a lot of times, and this goes for writers, this goes for directors, a lot of times people are, you know, given the task of actually cutting an episode, and they don't cut it well.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And then you could get a editor who's afraid, who's like, oh, no, you got to keep that in. Oh, the producers are going to be mad if you take that out.
It
happens all the time. And so then you might have a writer producer who's saying, don't take that out. Cut it all long. I want it all long. And then you get a director's cut that is intrinsically clunky. And then you're watching.
Well, but it's called the director's cut for a reason.
Right.
Because it's the director's cut. So I have to, I mean, I've said that many times in the editing room or when it's like,
I'm a
they can do what they want after, but I have to give in the best episode possible.
I'm a believer that the director should deliver the cut that they would want to see aired.
Absolutely.
And it should.
I always do.
I believe it should totally be that way.
And you're saying some directors don't.
Some directors are scared because they're so shell-shocked from other shows.
Got it.
Of cutting, like, the showrunner's favorite scene.
Right.
Cutting
right.
a line that,
because
like...
Because ultimately, because we're guests, they want to get asked back.
They want to be... And that's in the forefront of their minds. So they're like, let me just give it to them all dirty and they can go fix it. But right. consequently, if you give something that's 2 minutes over and it has no, like, temp music or something playing, it can play flat, especially if you play it with an audience. Mm-hmm. And then the director's screwed because then the people are like, the director's cut suck. That person shouldn't be asked back.
Right.
So it's a catch-22.
Yeah. No, you should always, directors should always do a director's cut and, you know.
But I do, what you were saying about how I think there are camps in town that are not collaborative. Mm-hmm. And so then when people come to collaborative places, and they even hear a criticism. Like, I worked with a director who was amazing. He had great, great cred. We were so excited to have him on the show. And when he came, I remember being in casting. Mm-hmm. And I'm in charge of, like, you know, we have 3 episodes with this actor
right.
coming up. So we're not just casting them for this episode.
Right.
We're casting them for more.
Right.
And I remember giving a note. After he had given a note, I said, can we try X, you know, because this is what he's going to be going through in the next episode. And he got all mad.
Right.
And then I remember we were like in a tone meeting. And I said something about, well, I really sort of want this to happen. Is there any way we could make that occur? And he got all mad and pissed off.
Mm-hmm.
And then he must have realized, like, as the week had gone by, that, like, oh, this is not the place where his thoughts were not going to be entertained.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he had gotten so much of his stuff in that he felt like he had to course correct. Because initially, he was defensive because he had been at shows where he was walked over so many times. He was sick of it. And I'm like, we're not trying to walk it over. We're not trying to walk over you. We're just trying to give you an opinion because this is an arc.
Right.
You know, we are actually on the same team and we want you to win.
Right.
And then he kept coming to my office asking me for my opinion. I said, I don't need to weigh in on everything.
Right.
I just needed to weigh in on that.
Right.
He was like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, there's a real pet peeve for giving direction to actors.
No, I know.
I would say that.
Yeah.
Sure. But... I mean, it's not my show, so why wouldn't I want to hear? But again, sometimes it's how things are communicated.
Right.
There's just, we just all need to talk about the truth.
Right.
No, but we need to talk about what really is going on because everyone wants to do a great job and everyone feels the same pressure to deliver a great show.
I think
that's always the goal that everyone has. 90% of the time. Sometimes people just get threatened by other people and want to leave their mark or piss all over everything, whatever. But for the most part,
I think so. I think you're totally right that for the most part, people want to do a great job. But I think this can also happen where you don't get a good script because the writer didn't give a damn on that episode.
Yeah.
And then you can also get a director who's like, ugh, I'm doing this show again. You know what I'm saying?
Well, then they shouldn't be doing that show.
Right. But it's a mercenary thing from the writer and the director at that point.
I've gotten a really lousy script.
Right.
And I got it many years ago. My third or fourth episode of TV. I don't remember which one. It was a really lousy script. And I was like, I've got to do something with this. And I've got to get everyone on board. I mean, it was really lousy.
Right.
Probably the worst script I've ever had to direct. And you know what? At the end of the day, it was like, all right, we're going to make like Rosemary's Baby. That's the movie. I got everyone on board with it.
This is what it is.
Costumes.
Right.
Like we had, you know, from the amulet that someone's wearing. I mean, the lighting. Pulled everyone on to make that, because that's what we were going to do, to entertain ourselves. And then afterwards, you know, I met with the studio and they were very honest and they were like, this is the worst script we've had in like, it was either a sixth or seventh or fifth season or something. Like the show had been on for a while.
Right.
And they were like,
tell me what show this is after.
They were like the worst. They were like, this is the worst script that we've had on the series. I called the person, the EP, and I was like screaming at him because I couldn't believe this was so bad. They were honest telling me this.
Right.
And they were like, we can't believe like what you did with that.
Right.
Like you actually turned it into something. And I was like, oh, so you can get something really crappy because everyone's expectations are so low.
Right.
And they're just going to get it done and let this be the one clunker. Because there's always one or two clunkers in a whole season.
Right. I think that's the key, too. Not every script is an A.
No.
Sometimes we don't have to talk about it.
We don't have to say the name. But I forgot about that script. That was like a really bad script, too.
But
that was too much politics.
That's the thing is sometimes you get thrown a script that is not good.
Correct.
And sometimes, for political reasons, everyone around it knows the script's not good.
I think most of the time they do.
Yes. Most of the time they do. And most of the time, the person's either too high to try to be honest with them.
Right.
Because you've tried being honest with them and you realize that they don't want honesty.
Right.
This is not how they operate. And then the other thing is people just do not want to, you know, use their political capital for that episode.
They're not going to fight for that one.
No, because they're thinking, I got to work on mine. I got to work on the next person's, or I'm rewriting the other person's.
Right.
And I got to just keep my head down because this is where you get your head blown off.
Right. I get it. That's politics.
That's politics.
That's what I learned. I mean, just, you know, people don't know, but like I made a feature.
Right.
Called Acts of Worship, went to Sundance, did all
Fantastic
this stuff, like
film.
my own like little world I created.
Right.
And then got into this shadowing program with John Wells. And that's how I transitioned. So I think those programs are great.
Right.
And can
Fantastic
open up like a way to make a living. But what I learned from that, people always ask me like, whoa, so what did you learn? Because the truth is, big movie or not, I haven't directed like a huge movie yet, but directing is still directing.
Right.
Whether it's a movie or TV, it's still the same craft.
Right.
Okay. You're just managing bigger parts or whatever. So it's like, no, I shadowed 6 directors and actually ended up shadowing 7. And no, what I learned was that TV is politics.
It's politics.
That's what I learned. Because no director is going to do the same thing. There's a million ways to cover a scene. Like there's just not like a formula. Particularly on Third Watch, it was very director driven.
Right,
so you have
like a mini movie.
You didn't have like a strict template. You could do handheld. You could do Steadicam. You could do do what you wanted. Basically, you just had to tell the best story,
right?
And that was the expectation, you know, character, action. But yeah, it was like no, I really didn't learn a lot about. You learn about doing things by writing. You learn about writing by writing. You learn about directing by directing.
But so much of TV writing is political.
It's all political, but the whole game is political.
It's all
production's political too.
Yeah, it's all political,
and it's like filled with landmines.
Yeah, it's a, you know, someone used to say like it's a pretty cake with razor blades in it.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
Yeah, I mean it's true because you are forced to lie to people every single day.
So you talked about like maybe you know somebody giving somebody notes and not really them wanting to hear it or accept it and just sort of let go and move on. So what have you had an experience where it was a very important person, influential,
right,
that really gave you like a note on something you were writing that was like completely like in your gut wrong? Like you just knew it was wrong, but they were insisting. And then how did you get around that? Or what did you do to sort of not piss them off, but make them feel like you were listening to them?
I mean, normally when you're coming up through the ranks, if someone above you is giving you a note, you take it because you've got to, that's part of the game of keeping your job. You've got to manage the person above you.
Okay.
And you've got to sort of listen to them. Sometimes you can have a note that is purely creative, where someone can say, you know, I don't think this is going to work. But in your gut, you believe it's going to work. And I had an incident like that happen on a show, and myself and the director got together and we just ignored everybody. And this was not, you know, I was an executive producer on the show and I was getting heat from people going, this is crazy. This is not going to work. 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 And I actually thought like, I've written 15 of these. I've been on the show for 5 years or 4 years. I've produced whatever, 100 episodes. Like, I actually have the opportunity for it not to work. So what if it doesn't work?
Right. But the director was down with trying to make it work for you,
right? The director was down for making it work. Like, we were like, let's get down and dirty.
But that's great.
And people, I remember even at the table read, people were like nervous about it. And I remember shooting, people were nervous about it. I remember when we cast, people were like, oh my God, here it comes. Here's the one with the blah, blah, blah. You know what I mean? People were really, really nervous. And ultimately, it was great because he stuck to your guns.
Right.
But the only way really you can stick to your guns is if you have a certain level of authority.
Right.
Because before, like, I remember, like, on Third Watch, getting notes from John Wells, for example. I got a note from him about a big 9/11 episode. And it was about whether or not, and I strategically, like, I specifically remember it because it was about whether or not one of the main characters could literally have run away from the towers as they collapsed.
Which is big.
Yeah, and hid because they were scared.
Wow.
And I fought. I remember being in, you know, before I got on the plane, when I landed, I remember it was like, John wants to talk to you. He wants to talk to you.
Yeah.
And he's my mentor. Like,
yeah,
I mean, I totally adore him. He, like, I'm doing a project with him. Like, he's my mentor. So I'm like, oh no, Big Daddy wants to talk. And so I get on the phone with him and he's like, we have to come halfway through this because we have to meet halfway. You've got,
he's trying to protect the character and not make him feel like he's
trying to,
whatever he's invested in, that he had courage. And then all of a sudden he's like running away and it just sort of pulled the rug out of everything you knew. Was that his fear?
I think he also just wanted to protect all of the heroes that really fought in 9/11. Like, this wasn't,
It was a bigger issue.
It was a bigger issue. Like, this was like, he as a producer, like a big,
because those episodes did come out great. I have to say,
they were
fantastic.
Amazing. And as a big producer, he was looking at what is the global story we're trying to sell and tell about, you know, NYPD officers and firefighters during that time.
Because this was a show, just so people know, this was a show that was shot in New York City.
It was shot in New York
and
City.
And it happened while 9/11 happened.
Yeah.
Production was there.
And we were doing like 3 or 4 episodes really dealing with it. And one of my, and this was like an episode that helped, like, you know, not knock me up a notch within their camp. But he, just as a storyteller, was like, I need you to look at the whole picture. And I remember fighting once. And then he's like, I need you to look at the whole picture. And I remember fighting again. And he was like, it's done. And when it was over and when we finally got the cut and we saw the performance, you got both. You got his fear of wanting to run away, but also the duty he had of showing up and saving people. And it was complicated.
Great.
It was great. And so you got to listen, especially when people with, you know, creative authority are talking.
Well, it's great when it's someone that you respect.
Yes.
That's what happens to me.
Yes, it's great.
So let's just say when there are people that I'm like, it's really hard to respect their taste. Mm-hmm. And yet they have authority for whatever reason.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for me. I will do it and I will do it with a smile and I will do it, but I will try to do something of my own as well. But I think what's cool about what you said before is that you had, I mean, this is what I love about you, is that you had a director, even though you were enmeshed in a group of people, you had a director willing to like get down with you and do something a certain way and support your vision. And to me, that's what great television does.
Yeah, I think,
it's like you just have this great collaboration where you can, you know, and I found working with you that way. Like you're so open and you know what you want, but you're also open to like, let's make it great.
Yeah.
And I just always want the opportunity to throw my ideas out there. Once in a while, if it's something really important, because I've seen every episode of the show.
Right.
There's a lot of shows that I do that I
have watched everything.
Everything.
Right.
So I'm not going in there not doing my homework.
Right. Of course.
You know what I mean?
Of course.
So there may be something that I might, like you said, you said it, brought it up to John, and then you brought it up again, and then you finally had to let it go.
Yeah.
There are times when once in a while, I have a hard time totally letting it go. And I don't get mad at, but I will try to like couch it away or find a political way to bring it up again, or maybe make it seem like it's their thought. Like sometimes there's stuff that's hard to let go. That's once in a while. But for the most part, I just throw my ideas out there. If they don't like them, fine. You move on. Move on to the next idea.
And I think that's what people want. People want you to be passionate. And then as the train is running, people want you to let it go. So you have to figure out, are you at that crossing the road where you've got to let it go, or you can keep pushing?
Yes.
It's hard. It's all.
But sometimes when there's problems with a script, because I am going to be the voice of the actors as well, I know that stuff is going to come up.
Yeah.
And it won't get dealt with during prep. And then sure enough on set, there you are with the problem. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And that's when it gets tricky for a director.
That's what's interesting. Like, I think a lot, and I've seen this with writers. I think a lot of people, and it could be myself included, like you are in denial of the script. And when you're out in public and you're doing the script, it's easier to blame it on other things. Mm. But I think when you Monday morning quarterback the problems with an episode, if it's really, really true, like if it's not on the page, it's never going to make it on film.
Right.
I mean, and that's where the first problems are. And I think there are writers who, and I've seen them, like I've seen writers, you know, write 25 drafts and they will work until the last day of shooting to keep making something better. Mm-hmm. And I've seen,
I love that.
Yeah. They will keep working. They'll keep finding.
I love
that. And because of the speed in which we do it, mm-hmm. like, of course you can keep rewriting it. Of course you can make it better, because you took a month with all these drafts and now you're in prep for 7 or 8 days and now you're shooting.
Well, and things come up during prep that can spark things and make it go in a different direction. And then when you're on set with the actors, things
can
come up.
It changes. It changes. And I think a lot of people go with the flow with those changes, but some people pride themselves on like, I only went to blue. Like I've heard people say this, I only went to blue. I'm like, what does that mean? Like you're like priding yourself and you did one rewrite? Like, you sound like a jerk.
See, to me, that sounds like somebody who turned in a script really late.
Yeah.
Like, the day before shooting.
Yeah.
And there was no time to make any changes. Yeah. And they were on to the next episode.
Or they're just chilling. And they're just sitting in, this is good. And they don't realize that the world has been structured to make them believe they're good.
Right.
And this is a true fact. It's like, And this was the thing about ER, which was so fascinating. Until you are around great writers, like if you like just on whatever show you deem as great, like there are amazing, amazing episodes of Third Watch, but like ER, where you say it's like a pinnacle of a medical show that's like undisputable.
Right.
Like unless you are around greatness and you have seen it and you have seen Forest Whitaker and Stanley Tucci or Ray Liotta or Forest Whitaker, any of those people act and Sally Field act, mm-hmm. you don't know what great is.
Right.
Like, you don't, like, you have to sit on the set of Breaking Bad. Right. You've got to be at Homeland. You've got to have an opportunity to be at some of the hot shows.
Right.
To have that experience. Because you don't know.
Right.
And so you know, Felix Alcala, a big director, always calls it the kind of mediocre in the middle. You actually can be treading water in the mediocrity, thinking that it's good. And fool yourself.
Right.
But when you get in the deep end and you get with like the big boys and girls who are really, really bringing great, and you go, oh, this is like whatever, you know, Masters of Sex or like it's the best. There's a reason why it's the best.
Right.
And everyone on set knows the difference between the best and exposition.
Well, I think it goes back to what you're saying. I think there's people in the industry and in every industry, I mean, corporate America all around,
right,
where there's people that are going to play things safe.
Right.
And they're going to try to not make waves.
Right.
But they're also not going to take risks.
Right.
And they're not going to really. Now, that gets back to what I wanted to talk about also, which is part of the reason that you're like my best friend in the whole planet is because you're super ambitious like me, mm-hmm, because we really want to take risks creatively and we want big payoffs.
Right.
And that's sort of, you know,
hard.
That's our blessing and that's our curse.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
So, because when you talk about like getting notes or working with people, I find people that work in television to be just super hardworking for the most part at the top of their game. I mean, really talented people,
right,
with a lot of experience. And what I love about, you know, again, people may not realize that, you know, these shows start out, a big network show that does say 22, 23 episodes will start in July, after July 4th.
Right.
And they will go all the way through April.
Right.
Right. With 2 weeks off in December. A couple holidays thrown in between, like long weekends, but
right,
2 weeks in December for Christmas.
And you're just going.
And they are going. And they are going, they're not just going over, you know, what we do is 12-hour days.
Right.
But there's a half hour for lunch in there, sometimes an hour. So you're talking, then you're talking about getting to set and back.
Right.
And then you're talking about wrapping equipment, right, wrapping trucks. You're talking about people that work like 14 to 16 hours a day, every day of their lives.
Right. It's huge.
They barely see their families.
Right.
So I always feel like I am, you know, I'm honored to be around those people.
It's huge.
Those are the people that I want to protect.
Right.
And those are the people that inspire me the most. Because those are the people when I want to get a shot or when there's a certain thing, they will go
like ride or die.
They
yeah
will go to the ends of right the earth to make it happen.
Right.
That's the kind of heart that people have in television.
Right. And it's real.
And I think the writers yeah that you're talking about that will, and you're one of them, that will like, I mean, right over the holidays, be at Christmas, right, not really being present, just like thinking about when right can I get in front of the computer with this idea that I like, how can I make
but
this
better?
There's
a lot of writers that don't do that.
I'm sure. And there's
and
a lot
don't
of directors.
They just want the money. Or they want the power, but they don't do that. Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah.
That. But those aren't the writers that are coming on
no
the show.
Yay!
And those aren't the writers
yay
that I really care
right
about.
Right.
But having said all that, I mean, you know, we're very ambitious. And I sent you something because sometimes we keep ourselves propped up, you know.
Right.
And one of the things about having a little bit of experience in this industry is that a lot of people are always, you know, you end up doing panels and then you end up mentoring people and or assistants want to meet with, you know, and
right
things like that. And so I find myself always trying to be a cheerleader for people coming up and trying to not feel like you're supposed to manage your expectations, which is
right
what I've been told by agents, managers,
right,
that they need to manage my expectations,
right,
which is ridiculous.
Right, right.
But like, how do you then have like this like desire to like follow your heart and your dreams to the end of the earth,
right,
and then manage to sort of ride all these politics? And so I feel like you need good people to push, keep you up all the time.
Right.
So one of these things that I sent you, I know it's a little out there, but it was this thing about letting go. And it says, when dogs play ball, they often want to repeat the joy of running after the ball again and again. Some dogs cling to the ball, not understanding that to keep playing, they must let go. When I desire to maintain an experience, I may get so attached to it that I block receipt of the very thing I want. Letting go of what I desire is the way to receive it. As I let go, I give over to spirit and trust my desired outcome or something better will come back to me. Clinging stops the law of circulation, the cycle of giving and receiving. So I just wanted to talk to you about that because the whole letting go thing and having it's eyes hard. On the prize.
Yeah.
But like also realizing that we're human beings that also need to have a life.
Right.
And this concept of like letting go of what I want so badly, which I just put it out there. I mean, I want an Academy Award. I want an Emmy.
I want a show.
And the reason I want those things is because, as we know, it's not about those things. It's not about the prizes. But those type of things are the things that bring creative opportunities.
Right.
It's just the bottom line.
That's how it is. Yeah.
You want to open up the creative opportunities. Right. I want to be in a box. You can only do female-led shows.
No.
Or you're only going to do little character-driven indie movies or...
So, my idol. I look at John Ridley. I go, he won the Oscar, and like the world's his oyster now. Like it's just, and I love him, and he was always amazing. But yeah, you're right.
So how do you navigate like keeping your eyes on the prize and wanting something so badly, but then knowing when to step back? And I don't want to be the one clinging to something, and that gets in the way. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the battle of it. I think you have to, I mean, and we talk about this all the time. I think you've got to find balance in your desire for what the goal is, but also living. Because I think the stories and the truth and like your voice, you know, I was reading this Elizabeth Gilbert book, Big Magic. Mm-hmm. And it's when you have big magic, when you have that feeling of like, aha, this is like amazing story to tell. It's when your mind is sort of calm. It's when you're open to stuff. And so you can sit in front of the computer and you can sit for 10 hours or you can like, you know, the other week when I was like freaking out and I called you and you're like, go to a museum, you know, go walk around. And I did that. I winded up going to the MoCA. I went downtown to another, you know, gallery. I walked around. I had dinner. I drank outside. Like I actually,
and how was that?
It was good. And what happens is your unconscious mind is working anyway.
It is.
It's talking to you anyway. And it's telling you like, oh, I got this. And so like the next day when you work and you sit down, it was like you were sitting there for 10 hours because the answers that you were looking for, they just sort of magically appear. But it's hard to listen to the answers or to hear the story when you are caught up in gimme, 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 gimme.
I know. Well, sometimes it's like, I feel like it's a focus for me of what I don't have.
Yeah.
Versus focusing on what I have.
Yeah. And we have a lot.
No.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, we have a lot. I had this like a tirade with my agent and then like it was so a nonsensical thing. Like we met for breakfast and we were going over a game plan of the next year or two or whatever. And we were talking about all the good things lining up and this is happening, this is happening, this is happening. And by the time I got home, like I wrote this email, like, and I'm so mad at this and blah, blah, blah. Like, because the anxiety of like sort of wanting it now, the anxiety of sort of hearing like, oh, the cable thing could take 2 or 3 years. Like, oh, this could take 1.5 years or that could take 5 years. Like all that anxiety was turning into anger instead of just relaxing. And, you know, it might not happen in 1 year. It might not happen in 2 years.
But it has to happen.
But it has to happen. And your job is to just keep putting the creative stuff into the fire. Like you just to keep fueling yourself and fueling the business.
Right.
But you can get panicked. And then the one thing I do, like, I know a lot of friends who do this. I don't do this because this would kill me. Like, but I tell this to every like up and coming writer, like do not look to the side and do not look at other people's game.
Oh my God. Comparing
do
where
not.
Other people are is the most self-destructive thing.
No,
I can do.
Like do not do it. Like you, like do not do it because everyone's grass can be appear greener or browner or whatever. It can all appear different ways. It's just a waste of time. Mm-hmm. I think you have to really look at yourself like a creative athlete. You're fueling yourself. You're running your own race. You're fueling yourself. You're running your own race. And when you see people like at the Olympics, they're not really looking to the side. They just don't because you lose that way.
Well, sometimes even the trades and stuff.
Yeah.
I just have to back off. from like reading Variety, reading Deadline, like just being consumed with this constant like, this one has this deal, this is happening here, and this, and I'm just like, what is that doing for me?
You can't. And it's so funny, like with Twitter and all of that, you can't be involved in it. You can be involved in a show, you're not even on the show because you're looking at it through Twitter. Like you're like,
well, that's another thing I wanted to ask you about with social media and how does. Do you find that helpful in your life? Do you not engage with it? Or what is your general opinion as far as like having dreams and like how does this fit into the politics of our careers or your career?
I mean, I think social media is key. Like if you have a show and you are launching the show, it is huge to talk to your fan base. Mm-hmm. And I think the fans are what can catapult your show from a success to a to a mega hit or whatever. But I also think like, you can't live in social media.
Big distraction.
It can be a big distraction. Like I, you know, for the last 5 seasons, which is like 100 and something episodes, was on Criminal Minds. I was an executive producer. It was a huge part of my life. Right. I love everyone there. I love all the crew. I love all the cast. I could look at Criminal Minds posts every minute. Like there's stuff every single.
There's so many millions of fans.
There's millions of fans, and then there's people in the crew posting. Like these are friends that I, you know, go to dinner with, mm-hmm. posting and saying stuff. But like as a creative who's trying to build something different right now in my life, I can't live there. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I can't. It's just like I can't. Like I love Orange Is the New Black. I can't sit on Orange Is the New Black's website and like read about every single girl and see, oh my gosh, what are they doing? Oh, what's their storyline? Because you just can spend so much creative energy living in a universe that has nothing to do with what you're trying to create. I think as a creative person, you've got to free yourself to have a mind space open so that new characters can talk to you, mm-hmm. so they can whisper in your ear. But if you're chatty with like 18 shows and you're like, oh my God, guess what happened on Better Call Saul this week? And then the writers did this and then
it's so overwhelming.
It's too much.
It's so overwhelming.
It's too much. And then like you can spend 3 hours of your day looking at, you know, Shonda Rhimes' lineup on Thursday.
Well, what I do is like, if I have an episode that airs, I will do it. Because one of the things I'm realizing is, you know, I don't know how you feel about
promote.
Like people talk about, you know, like having a brand. Like I think about like a writer, director, writer. Like kind of person like Lee Daniels or something who has looked at his career as sort of like a brand.
Yeah.
Like I'm a brand.
Yeah.
And there's certain people that succeed that sort of look at their life that way or
I think that's key.
So how does that work for you?
I think it's key in establishing a brand.
So does that not happen until you have your show on the
air? I think it's easier to do that when you have your show on the air. I think you can do it. You can market your brand as it relates to the show you're doing that you didn't create. But I think most people who launch a brand get known for something that they create or they started from the ground up.
Right.
I think if, you know, you or I were to create whatever, I'm just naming Homeland as an example.
Right.
I think you could create a brand behind or empire. Like Lee Daniels is saying, I am the voice.
Well, I think
visionary.
He was doing it before that, like with his movies. Well, like Lee Daniels presents.
And I think that's
key. It's a thinking.
I think it's key.
Right.
And I think it's selling to the industry what he is. And he's not just a journeyman, you know, writer or director.
Right.
He's saying, I am the thing that you have to pay attention to.
That's my biggest fear. You just said the words that are my biggest fear.
I think the journey.
Which is to become known as a journeyman director.
It's
like horrifying to me. Well, I just want to say. That's just me.
I think that, well, here's
nothing wrong with that.
No. And I think that's horrifying to be a journeyman writer for some people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
well, for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
For some people, it's okay.
No. I mean, I want proof of my existence. I want creative proof of my existence.
Yeah.
And I don't want to just be a replicator. Like, I don't want to be known for just being able to replicate someone else's vision of a show or a movie or whatever. I want to be able to say, this was my voice. This is what I came up with in my pajamas. I was given a shot and this was the best thing I had in me at the time. And I think that's the fight for a lot of writers. It's not the fight for all writers because I've met tons of writers who hate writing. So, you know what I mean? I think that's a fight for a lot of creatives.
Some writers just want to be directors. There are some. There are those writers yeah. that just want to be directors. They're not necessarily.
Yeah. I think a lot of, you know, so funny. I think a lot of writers move to wanting to direct. I mean, I've talked to you about this recently because they get so scared that they're not going to be able to see their story on the air. They're so sick of waiting for the business mm-hmm. to give them permission to do it that they're mm-hmm. finally like, you know what? If I write and direct it, maybe finally I can get 20 people in a movie theater and they can all see it.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's what I tell younger people yeah. when they're coming up. It's just like, don't sit around for the next mm-hmm. 10 years waiting. Even if you're an actor.
Yeah.
Go make a short.
Just go make
do
it.
Something.
Go just create.
You got to create. Everyone's yeah. got to create because there's so much now. It's even harder to make noise.
Yes.
Or waiting for an opportunity. It seems like the illusion is there's so much opportunity out there. And there is a lot of opportunity, but somehow it can go to similar channels or down the same roads.
I agree with you. I think there's a lot of opportunity to make television mm-hmm. or to make a movie. But you do, the key to what you said earlier is like, you've got to make noise.
Right.
And it has to be loud or be like, the TV show has to be loud.
But at the same time, I think it's really mm-hmm. not necessarily useful for me
right.
as an artist mm-hmm. to be concerned with what's going to make noise. Or be loud. Because when I get consumed with that, that's the same kind of thinking just for me.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's like I have to do what's going to make me feel really fulfilled inside.
Right.
And nobody really knows what that noise is going to be. It could be right. anything. It could be exactly what's from your heart. And hopefully, like a show like Breaking Bad, I don't think anyone would know that would become. And it took some time after it was on the air.
Right,
it didn't
right,
just
right,
come
right,
out
right,
and
right,
make
right.
noise.
I don't. Okay, so this is a better way to say it. It's like, I think the originality will rise.
Right.
And that's what we all have to fight for. Because the audience is so savvy now. They've got so many outlets for television. So you can write something and you can go like, I have two cops and they're solving this crime. Right?
Right.
Like
right.
whatever that right. show's called or what, I'm just making that up. Or I have a doctor and he's going to save, right. you know, sick people.
Like, right.
I think the loudness has to be, how do you turn it an inch to make a public view something that they've seen a million times in a different way? And I think those are the questions that we have to ask ourselves. Because can you make something that is just two cops stop? Yes, you can. You can.
But I think it's more than that because mm-hmm. I think there's a myth that originality and talent uh-huh. will find its way. And I don't think, I honestly
right.
don't think that's true. I think that's naive viewpoint because I think that it also takes, there's serendipity involved. There's something involved.
Absolutely.
That will take that originality and like push it forward. Maybe it's because your dad owns a network. I mean, there right. are many factors that go into why those things happen, because there's, as we know, there's a lot of, it's almost a myth, I think, that hurts people that if something doesn't happen major that you create,
right.
maybe I say this because, you know, I saw my first movie at the multiplex near you or something, and I think it's a great movie,
mm-hmm.
but without the right backing behind it or the right sort of team or people to sort of navigate or get it to a certain place, it's not going to make that noise.
I agree with
that's
that.
That's all I'm saying.
I totally agree with
I
that.
I think there's a lot of people in the world making movies right now that are great, and it's very hard for them to get their movies seen.
I totally agree with that. I think in that, though, because it's hard to get anything seen, mm-hmm. because so much stuff is getting
right.
seen,
right.
you have to do your best to fight for originality.
Agreed.
And keep fighting for originality. And I also think that sometimes the outcome of something isn't what we want,
mm-hmm.
but it leads us to the step of the next thing.
Well, that goes back to what I think our careers are more
yeah.
like, which is, you know, you talk about like Olympics or racehorse or something. Like, it's like, I feel like you and I are in this like, we are moving forward constantly.
right, right, right.
We have not
absolutely.
Stopped moving
no,
forward.
No, absolutely not.
But we're not the ones that are like going ka-ching, like way
right.
up here,
right.
blowing up like crazy. Because
mm-hmm.
I do know some of those people.
Right.
And then they go away. Their career is, it's for various reasons.
Right, right, right.
They can't get there again.
Right,
they can't
right.
sustain that. And I'm like, all right, well, I'm just like the trudger who's going to keep going.
Right.
Step at a time. and we're not, when, you know, if we fall, we help each other get up.
Right. And just keep going.
We just keep going.
And keep going.
And I think at the end of the day, it's like, okay, the only thing that needs to happen, original, not original, whatever's in your heart, is you just can't give up.
Right. And I think you have to just keep doing it. Like you have to keep practicing. And I only stick on the originality because I do think that is ultimately the key.
I just think that it's naive to say that's all.
No, it's a culmination. It's a culmination.
Look, I have sat on panels for 10 years.
Yeah.
And like, there are so many panels where people will be like, well, if it's good enough, it'll just
No.
That's just not really fair to tell a group of artists in a room.
No.
It's like, wait, there's talented painters and no one's ever seen their painting.
Right.
So there's other things that have to happen.
Yeah.
But definitely trying to do something that goes back to like what's going to make noise, trying to do something that you think is going to make noise because it's like something else or because you think somebody's going to want that is very difficult as an artist to sort of do. I mean, you and I try to be smart about the business.
Right.
But then I'm going to make, you know, and I do that with more with my choices and television shows that I'm going to direct. But when I'm going to make a movie, it's just got to be straight from my heart because it's just got to be what I want to see and what I'm not seeing in the world.
Right.
In my world, like I don't see certain things. Then there's a void.
There's
and
a void
my
in
my heart. Is
and,
like,
and I think that's
I
being
need
truthful.
To give these characters a voice.
And I think that's being, and I think originality coincides with being truthful and honest.
Right.
And so as long as you're honest, I don't think you should sit there and go, I have something in my heart, but this is more loud, let me do that. I think you should do whatever the story is that you want to do in this loudest way possible.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Totally
whatever that is and pushing it the way you can push it.
I totally agree.
Because I do feel like right now, I mean, you probably feel this way on a Saturday night. There's so many choices.
Yeah, there's so many choices.
And it's hard to get somebody to turn the channel to watch you or to, you know what I mean?
There's so many choices. I can't actually keep up anymore.
Right. There's so many choices.
I just can't keep up. So there was this guy talking about like quality, talent, originality that he passed away. And I saw his obituary and I just wanted to give him some props. And I sent this to you. This gentleman, Ken Adam, who was the production designer of a lot of James Bond movies. He worked with Stanley Kubrick. He designed the flying car of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. He worked on Kubrick's Barry Lyndon and on The Madness of King George. And he did Dr. No. And he did The Spy Who Loved Me. And he did Goldfinger. Like,
that's huge.
Huge. And like, these are one of these people that, no, he didn't get famous or we don't really know who he is. Right. Or at least it's not common, Ken Adam.
Right.
But I think it's amazing that like the people that go into this, I bring this up because this is why it's a collaborative medium.
Yeah.
Because it takes all of people's vision, every single person. And no more than anything's a director's medium.
Right.
I don't think it's a writer's medium. Right. I think it's like a group of people that take this and just say, we're going to put our hearts in it and we're going to make it the best possible.
I agree with that.
That's, I think, what makes people, that's what makes it things original.
Right.
That's what makes things elevated.
Right.
That's why I believe that because I'm a collaborative director, I think that's why my episodes, there's not
are
one
so
episode
great.
I've right. directed. I'm not saying they're great, but I'm proud of them.
Right.
Because I know a lot of people put their heart into them.
Right.
And people feel that.
Right.
It
right,
shows.
Right.
And that's what I think, you know, that's what I think is important is to honor people that do their best work. And it's really not about ego, is it?
Yeah. No, it can't be about ego. And I think when it becomes about ego, you lose.
And I think when I suffer, it's because I'm caught up in my ego of like, wait, I want that Academy Award. Where's my Academy Award?
I know, though.
And I'm miserable.
We all have the angst of like the holidays. Like, oh, here it comes.
Oh, my God. Actually, I love the holidays because I feel like even Easter weekend is like, thank God.
Right.
I am such a loser if I actually send an email which actually a couple people do, though. Still what? Do business over, like, holiday weekends.
I do.
But, I mean, I know. I'm not talking about writing. I'm talking about communicating with other people in a business way, like on emails and stuff. Sometimes the holidays are just great for me to step back, like you said, because I'm like, I'm going to look like a loser if I'm actually not celebrating this holiday today. They're going to think, because I don't have kids, there's no family around, so, like, I'm just obsessed and a loser who works all the time. No?
I don't know.
You're like the same way.
I don't know. I mean, I think people in this business love it. I do think that, I mean, people just love it. I think we need to find balance. That's really key.
Balance.
But I think part of the email on the weekend is just the love for it, you know?
I do. I really do. And I remember, you know, yeah. And part of the social media thing for me too is, like, I have to say there's something where I don't, you know, I get to work with these amazing actors and on some of these amazing shows.
Right.
And I'm like, you know, at first I was like, oh, I'm not going to post pictures of me with these actors. But the truth is, I'm so fucking excited
that proud.
Like, I get to work with, like, Ryan Hurst and, like, Juliana Margulies. And I'm like, so when I post a picture like that, I hope it comes across that it's like, first of all, it makes me grateful. Because if I feel, like, miserable in the moment and then I look at these photos, I'm like, I was so happy in that moment because I'm collaborating with this talented artist.
Yeah.
And we're having fun.
Yeah.
It's not about all the bullshit.
No.
It's like you're creating something and it's magic. Whatever that moment is, it comes down to little moments of magic.
Yeah.
Right?
Huge. Huge. The big
They're
magic.
Huge.
Yeah, that's totally true. It's so funny. I was walking out of a pitch this year and I was going to another one. I was a little nervous and I just needed that calm over me, like everything was okay. And I looked at my email and it was an email from Joe Mantegna who said, I was just thinking about you, kiddo. I saw an episode that we did, this episode, Strange Fruit, and it was brilliant. And it was just brilliant. And I just wanted to remind you of how brilliant it was. And in that moment, I was like, you know what? Like that, like little uplift, like that thing that you wrote touched someone. And in the middle of nowhere, a year and a half, 2 years later, an actor who experienced it, you know, gives you a shout out. You're going, you know what? Just keep going. Because those are the moments that we sort of live for.
Yeah, we do.
When we know it's magic.
Yeah, when we know. And the actor's done so much work and work with so many amazing people and writers.
Exactly.
So that's huge.
It's huge. Absolutely huge.
So good. Well, thanks. I really am so happy that you came tonight. I know you had
great.
A cold.
I did. I'm sorry.
Your voice
keep
cleared
drinking.
Up. You totally cleared up. I thank you so much. I can't wait. So we're going to wait to see your own show on the air really soon.
Yes.
You're going to be kicking ass. And,
and you too.
Where do people find you, Janine?
I'm at JS Berrois at... J.S. Berrois. Janine Sherman Berrois on Twitter. I'm sorry.
Are you on Facebook?
I'm not on Facebook.
Okay, so Twitter and Instagram?
On Instagram, yeah.
Okay, you can find Janine and you can find, my movie is
Janine
Silver...
Sherman Berrois, yeah.
Is sorry. It? What is it?
Janine Sherman Berrois on Twitter and J.S. Berrois on Instagram.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Check her out.
Yeah.
Follow Janine. She's going to be big time.
Woohoo!
Really soon. And my movie is Silver Skies of the Movie. Go on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram is at Rosemary Directs. And see you soon.
Awesome.
Come on, people. It's time to live it up.